This week, on a very personal episode of Hello Ross, we look back at an in-depth, hilarious, and little heard conversation I had with my amazing friend, Leslie Jordan.
A friend called from California and said, honey, you've gone viral.
Yeah.
And I said, no, I'm fine. I don't have the corona. I thought he meant you.
It's Leslie Jordan today on Hello Ross. Hello, everybody, and welcome to the program. I'm not going to lie to you. This is a tough time right now because we lost a beautiful light, a beautiful human being. Leslie Jordan, my friend, passed away on Monday. I was sitting right here in my office here in New York when I got the news. It just popped up on my phone, and I couldn't believe it. Leslie Jordan, dead at 67. I had to read it over and over and over again. Well, you guys probably too, right? And it's not just because he was my friend. I feel like everybody felt like they were Leslie's friend. He had that beautiful gift. His superpower was making us happy, whether you knew him or not. And it's the reason, this superpower, this gift that Leslie had to make us smile was the reason that during the darkest time, you know, the pandemic, it seemed like we all found our way to Leslie. He went from having a few, you know, thousands of followers to like 6 million followers. And it's because Leslie was just being Leslie. Leslie was just putting out light into the world. And it was when we needed it most. Leslie was there for us. I was so happy to see him have so much success. And I have to tell you, in real life, Leslie was exactly the same. Exactly the same. Funny, naughty, quick, kind. You know, I got to sit down with him about a year and a half ago or so. And it was when I was thinking about this podcast, about when I was thinking about having those kind of deeper conversations, about talking to people who I find fascinating and going a little below the surface, interviewing people in a way that you don't get to in these, like, you know, 4-minute quick sound bites, which I'd done. I'd interviewed Leslie a bunch of times before, but I'd never had a chance to really sit down with him. And when I was sort of brainstorming this show, I thought, who would I want to talk to? And Leslie was one of those people. So I asked him, I reached out and I just texted. I said, would you do this thing with me? I want to, like, interview you and kind of go there. And he was like, okay, honey, whatever you want, I'll do it. And he sat down with me and it was just one-on-one. And it was kind of like a pilot for this show in a way. And he showed up and he did it for me. And that is very much who Leslie was. He just showed up and he was so funny. I was so proud of the conversation we had because I could, you know, really go there with him. And he went there. And what I was so fascinated about was talking about little Leslie, little gay Leslie growing up in the South, going to church, and what that was like. And what was it like now, you know, when he was, I guess, 66 at the time, being like a gay icon, you know? How did he make peace with that in his mind? How was his relationship with God in that? And you know what? I got to know Leslie so much more after our conversation and through our conversation. So when I was sitting here in this chair and trying to process that Leslie was gone, I thought about that conversation we had about a year and a half ago. And I thought, that's what I want to play this week. I want you guys to hear that. I want you to hear the Leslie that I knew, who was funny, sweet, gracious, and so happy to be having the kind of success that he got to experience. I'd love to play that interview for you now. This is me and my friend, Leslie, not that long ago.
America starts the day with America in the Morning.
First of three pushes of storminess.
Hi, I'm John Trout, your host for the latest news, politics, entertainment, business, and weather.
A speech with political overtones.
Our staff of correspondents provide a fast-paced look at the world with specialized reports from where news happens.
Judge's decision was based on finding there is a
likelihood.
So
far, the central bank appears to be threading that.
Concise, accurate, and fresh each day.
America in the Morning, the podcast, available wherever you listen.
Our house is a mess. Come on in.
I'm Amber Wallen, internet comedian and host of your new favorite podcast, Fly on the Wallen.
Okay, that's pretty presumptuous to assume that this is going to be their favorite podcast, by the way.
Anyway, that wasp that you just heard interrupt me is my husband.
And co-host, Benjamin Wallen.
Listen in as we discuss relationships and keeping our sweet baby kid alive.
Fly on the Wallen, wherever you listen.
Hi, my love. I'm so happy you're here.
Thank you for having me.
Well, you know, you're one of my favorite people in the entire world. I remember, I don't know if you'll remember this, but the first time I ever met you was probably in like 2008. And I was at the Abbey at like a happy hour or something. And you walked by, I think you were there getting lunch or something. And you said to me, like, I gotta go. I got a trick. I gotta go. And then you floated out. And I was like, I don't know if he's serious or not, but what, no matter, whatever he's going, that was hilarious.
And then we had that fun time. Do you remember being in the parking lot? Where were we?
San Diego.
San Diego.
Yeah, on the morning news. Bill and Juliana Rancic were there as well.
Yes. And there was a newscaster named Wisdom.
Yes!
You remember that?
You're so right. I forgot about Wisdom. Yeah.
And I had to throw the first pitch out. No, honey, we were in D.C.,
Were we in D.C.? Where were we?
We were in Washington,
D.C. And you were there, and you were there. Oh, I thought.
And you were there, and you were there. And she was there. Juliana. Juliana was there. I want to say Miss Rancic.
Yeah.
She was there, but she, I had to throw the first pitch out for the Washington Nationals on that Tuesday. I'd been coerced into that. am I wrong? We were both in D.C. when we had been in D.C. And
we must have been there, and they booked us on like the morning news or something.
Yes, we were both there.
But like not
and I
together.
I said I couldn't throw a baseball, and he said, "Well, come out here in the parking lot, and I'm going to show you."
Yeah, and then I went out there and I tried to help you throw a baseball, and that is never a good idea. No, but it's so funny the random ways we bumped into each other, and I just but I feel like I have adored you for so long, far before I knew you. And and it's like, you know what you have, Leslie, and I think you probably are aware of this, but you have that thing that just makes people happy, right? Did you have that as a little kid? I can picture you as a little boy just putting on shows for your mom.
Everything. Now, I was, you know, a little boy with a secret, and my dad was a lieutenant colonel in the Army. And so there was kind of all of that. He also was killed in a plane crash when I was 11, which was kind of horrible time to lose your dad.
Yeah.
But, you know, I was a joyful child. You know, I did have a lot of fun, but I just always felt like, you know, I wasn't good at sports. You know how we have all that internal baggage we just drag around, and I look back. But no, I had a wonderful childhood. And yes, I've been gifted with the ability to make people laugh and to make people feel good about themselves. And it really hit home during the pandemic when I started posting things, things. I posted twice a day for 80 days, and all of a sudden I had 5.7 million followers.
Yeah, I saw this happening, and it was because I followed you before. You were always funny on Instagram, right? And then the world shuts down. We're all locked away, and I'm sure you've told this story a million times, but you did go from like having a loyal following, myself included, to like just something happened. People were dying for content, and you recognized it and just gave the people what they wanted. Walk me through what that was like.
I have no idea. I was in Tennessee when the shelter in place orders came. And I thought, well, I'll just stay here. You know, I knew I couldn't stay under the roof with mama and the twins. I have identical twin sisters. And so it's just really the four of us.
Oh, I love that you can say sentences like mama and the twins.
Mama and the twins.
Yeah.
Mama and them.
Uh-huh.
But anyway, I rented a tiny apartment near them so that I could, you know, stay in like we were supposed to. But I would also go over and visit, you know, them every day and get material for my boats. And so that was when it just took off. And I have no idea. Like people say, you know, help me out. How did it work? I don't know. I don't know how that just.
Do you think it was like, you know, I talked a bit at the beginning that you just make people happy. And I think, you know, a lot of times if we just sort of relax, we find our purpose. Right. And I feel like in the pressure cooker of Corona and lockdown and pandemic and all of that, you just went to what you do naturally.
I think that's it. And I, you know, I started out, like you said, with a loyal group of followers. But then when it mushroomed like that, when you get up to that many followers, you get without thinking about it, I knew I wasn't going to go anywhere near politics, and I didn't want to go anywhere near religion. And I also didn't want to push products. Mm. I thought, you know, that's not why people tune in to see me. And even when you do it in a sly kind of way, like where someone's paid you to perhaps take a sip of tea and it's Lipton or something, you know. Yeah.
But why not do that? I mean, it is the way of the world now. People do. I mean, I do some advertising on my social media. I do, because I mean, it's a currency. Social media is like, you know, your channel now, think of just your Instagram alone gets the kind of ratings major networks would die for. Right. So if they can sell a Super Bowl ad for $1 million, why couldn't you?
Well, what I've noticed, and I have people that are helping me with all this, is the minute we go there, we lose followers. They just are not interested anymore.
Well, you know, but we're working girls, honey. We got to make a living, right? Any way we can.
But I'm lucky right now in that I've got a series on the air, which
you do. I do want to know quickly though, what that felt like as you, as the world is turning to your Instagram for relief and healing in this crazy time, which is, who would have thought? Are you sitting there refreshing, seeing the numbers grow from, you know, 100,000 to 200,000 to 1 million to over 5 million now? Are you refreshing it? And what is going through your mind?
No, I didn't pay attention to any of that, really. A friend called from California and said, honey, you've gone viral.
Yeah.
And I said, no, I'm fine. I don't have the corona. I thought he meant you. You've gone viral. I said, no, I'm fine. He said, no, honey, internet viral. And I kind of knew what that meant, but I don't really pay attention to the numbers.
Did you manage to grow up liking yourself, even though?
No, not internally, really. That happened, believe it or not, when I got sober 22 years ago. My journey for the last 22 years has been into that. Here I was just everybody thought I was the happiest guy, but I just, you know, there was a little dark cloud and I didn't feel real good about myself. I am 100% comfortable with who I am and what I am at 65 years of age, which is pretty amazing.
What's your relationship with God or the church now that partly that they were
a very complicated sort of relationship? I seek, you know what I mean? I keep an open heart. And I seek, and I'm open to, there's many, many paths to God. See, the way I was raised, we were told one way, you know, and I have my own little path, you know, and I think it's very personal. And, you know, I loved when I heard once in recovery, religion is for people who are afraid of going to hell. Spirituality is for those who've already been there. So
I love
spiritual
that.
Person and, you know what we went through. You went through it too, some, I'm sure. Maybe not your generation, quite like my generation, but growing up gay was not easy in the Deep South. And I had an easy go because I was funny. You know, I could keep the bullies at bay. I was so
funny.
Did
you find that humor was your weapon? The same. My dad, he taught me how to swear and he taught me how to be funny because he knew, I think, if bullies came my way, I could just sort of, you know, slice them in half with a good joke. And that was your same experience?
Exactly.
What about losing your dad at so young? I wasn't aware that you lost him so young. How did that affect you?
He was a career army man and his plane went down. I was 11, and it was a really, really, really tough go because I think more than anything, I felt that maybe I hadn't been the son I could have been, you know, because I wasn't good at sports. And I even asked my mother one time, I said, do you think he was in any way ashamed of me? And you would have thought I had slapped her. She was flabbergasted. She said, Les, your daddy adored you. Aww. What are you? Where would you ever have even gotten it? And I thought, you know what? That's all that internal baggage that we tell ourselves. It has absolutely nothing to do with the reality of the situation, because he was a loving man and he was a good man. But it was the 1950s and you've got a kid that can't even hit it off the tee ball. You know?
What do you think your dad, you know, if he were still here and he could see how fully you are. Hold on, let me say this. How fully you are and how fully celebrated you are in the masses, you know, what would that blow his mind?
And I think it's interesting. My dad used to pull out a baritone ukulele and play old hymns, and we would sing. Oh, I knew every word. We would sing, and then he would make up these funny little songs. My daddy was a shaving, as the story goes, the razor slipped and it cut off his nose. We'd just make up these songs and sing. I don't know where they came from. And that's what I'm doing now. It's all full circle. I'm recording the favorite hymns of my dad and my mom. And I have no axe to grind with that. I've dealt with all that, you know, so it's singing just because I love the songs and because they bring comfort to so many people. I do this Sunday morning hymn singing with my friend Travis Howard. And we sing these old songs, you know. People will write us on Instagram and tell us, oh, I'm an atheist. You know, they'll say that.
Yeah.
I'm an atheist. I tune in every Sunday to hear those songs. Wow.
I find this so fascinating, you know, that you must have done a lot of work to get to this place, you know, where you are so content with who you are and how your relationship with God and all of that, a lot of work. And I'm actually thinking about, as I'm reflecting, because I think there are a lot of parallels between you and me, although we had very different upbringings. I was in Washington State, but the farm town with a hunter dad, and we were not religious people, but my dad used to teach me these songs. He would have me sing for good luck where we'd be fishing or hunting. And one of them, like you were just singing that hymn, and I was my dad would teach me, and one was, oh, the hair on her pussy was a fuzzy brown color and the fleas and the ticks were a fucking one another. Have me sing them and do these awful chants, and we would always get fish. But the point is, like, it made my dad happy, you know, and like it was the way I could bond with him. And so I was so grateful to have that. And when your dad passed, did you feel like you were the man of the house then?
I didn't, but people told me that. And that's a terrible thing to tell. You know, people said, you're the little man of the house now. And
a lot of pressure.
Felt the weight of the world on me. And then so many of my dad's, like my uncles and stuff, stepped in to try, and that kind of was hopeless. And then one uncle figured it out with horses. That was what we bonded with, because I'd always had a pony. Mm-hmm. My dad bought me my first pony when I was four.
I couldn't even get my little pony. My parents, are you kidding me? You had a pony? That's the dream.
But see,
what'd you name your first pony? What'd you name it?
Midnight. Midnight. And I had him till I was 14. But then I had a fancy one, Lemon Drop.
Snow
pony named Lemon Drop. I've told that before. My friend said, well, of course you had a show pony named Lemon Drop.
Oh my God, you're living my fantasy life.
But see, in the South, there was plenty of land and there were barns everywhere. And you didn't have to be rich. People think, oh, wait, you must have been rich. No, you could have horses and they just grazed in the pasture and you gave them a little grain every once in a while.
Yeah.
But I bonded with an uncle over horses, and that was kind of wonderful.
I wonder what it was like growing up and dating? Like, who was your first crush?
My first crush was, I was in Daytona Beach. I was about 12 years old with my family. And I remember I met this kid. He was a little older than me, but he took a liking to me. And I don't remember his name, but I do remember I asked my mother, I said, I want to keep, you know, after the vacation's over, maybe I could write him a letter. She said, I asked for his address, and he wrote me his address down. And all the way home, I remember I was very dramatic. We were at a station wagon driving away from Daytona. And I'm just with tears going down my face, staring out the window for my love, my new love. And I wrote him a letter and he never wrote back. So I even remember where he lived. It was at Harding Place in Nashville. I remember the address is 60 million years ago.
That
was my first, but I didn't know that. And I would get those, you know, my trouble was that I always went for people that weren't available. Like maybe they're straight. Hello.
Did you do that your whole life, you think?
My whole life. What
about now, dating now? What's going on?
I'm just, you know, single and happy and I don't do much. At 65, you know, I look around my beautiful little place and I think there's just no room here. There's no room.
Well, if you found it, would you? I'm not one of those people who say like you have to have a partner. I hate when people ask people that. And if they're content, they're content. But say you were at Starbucks and someone bumped into you and you felt that magical.
Yeah, but I've been around so long that I know that it's relationships are so much work. And I've had some beautiful boyfriends over the years. And then, you know, 2 or 3 years in, I don't know. I think I'm going to probably go it alone. I'm 65 and I'm so happy. What could they bring to the table?
Well, you do have it all, right? You're in this position. I love that you're in this position where you're established, you're wholly in yourself, right? And now you have this brand new humongous platform where you kind of have that ticket to do whatever you want. And I love that you're doing a gospel album, which details will be coming out soon. Sounds like you have huge people. You're on a sitcom on Fox with Mayim Bialik, who was Blossom. Hello. One of my faves.
Hello. And she's exactly like you think she was. She's so smart. You know, she has a doctorate.
She does.
She's Dr. Bialik.
Yeah, right. In like mathematics or something
like that.
Something scientific. Who, what?
Something. She's so smart. And you know, it's funny. We have a running joke. She can do anything. Like one episode where she needed to kickbox. And all of a sudden really kickboxing. She said, I took classes once. She's done everything. I mean, there's nothing she can't do. Nothing.
That's amazing. And so tell me about the show.
We're having so much fun. I know everybody says that. Oh, we have fun. But I mean, we really have fun.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like we've got Cheyenne Jackson, who's just so beautiful and so talented and so much fun. And we have Julian Gant, who just is he was on in the Groundlings and everything. He's just intrinsically, and little Kyla Pratt just tickles me to death. I mean, I just can't get my eyes off of her. She's so pretty.
Call Me Kat. And what is the show about and who is your character? It's on Fox.
It's on Fox. And Mayim Bialik, her mother is Swoosie Kurtz, who I forgot to mention immediately.
Oh my God, I love
Swoosie
Kurtz.
She's like a legend.
Legend.
So Swoosie. And her dressing room is right next to mine. And we glommed onto one another. And that's all we do is they can't find us sometimes to go shoot. They'll come say, well, where are they? Well, I think he's in Swoosie's dressing room. I don't know. Well, you've got to find him. We're just having such a good time. But anyway, Swoosie wants her daughter to get married. You know, she's 40 years old. My gosh, it's a little bit of an embarrassment.
Yeah.
Because Swoosie plays fancy. You know, she's a little wealthy. She's got a few dollars. And,
understood.
And then she's got her daughter, you know, Catherine Edith. Catherine Edith Silver. Uh-huh. And Catherine Edith is not married. And she's just appalled by her. And they have that cute thing going. And then so she takes her dowry and buys a cat cafe where you can go in there and rescue cats and have tea. And so I help run the cat cafe.
Now, when you get this kind of script, are you like, I can nail this part right away. I know exactly how to do it. And do they have you audition? Or are you at the point now where they offer it to you?
No, they do not offer. They made me come in and audition. And I got the part that Julian Gant has now. That was what I was hired to play.
Oh, okay.
And then there was a character named Phyllis. She was kind of a large woman. And she was kind of pitiful. Her boyfriend had left her and and I remember thinking I could tear that part up if not as Phyllis, but I just knew she had the best lines. Mm. So Darlene Hunt that created the show called and she was hemming around and I knew what she was up to. She said, we can't find our Phyllis. And I said, I'll come in. I'll audition. You can make him feel. She goes, okay. I was just going to ask you to put a couple of lines on your on your cell phone and send them to us. I said, no, I'll come in. So I went into to a waiting room with several funny large women, and I went in and I wanted to tell them y'all could go home now because I'm going to get this part. I just knew.
You just knew it.
She called the next day and said, we're going to give you this bigger part.
Amazing.
And so I knew immediately. I thought, I can do this. And now the scripts are getting better and better and better.
Now, are you good at auditioning? I'm terrible. I just booked a first thing with an audition. I've been on television 20 years. It's never been how I've gotten gigs. I get insecure about things. What about you?
I've gotten better at it. It's nerves. It all boils down to nerves. And it all boils down to, people would tell me, oh, just go in there and do it and then forget about it. Well, you can't forget about it. I want to tell them, get in the car. Hey, all of you get in the car with me, because when I drive home, I'm brilliant. Like when I leave this audition, yeah. I'm so brilliant. Mm-hmm. Get in the car and I'll blow you away. And that for years I noticed was when I did get offers or when people did bring me in, I got it. But when I auditioned, 9 times out of 10, I didn't get it.
Well, is there ever a part that you didn't get that they made a mistake? They should have had you. You would have killed it.
It's funny you said that, because I answered that question the other day and I got in trouble. But I was kidding. Willie Garson on Sex and the City.
Yes.
I was up for that part and they just went a whole different way. I mean, they didn't go a whole different way. He's straight though.
Yeah.
And so the other day I said, and then this straight guy gets the part, and I refused to watch Sex and the City. Well, I got a direct message from Willie. So sorry. And then I wrote back and said, no, I was kidding.
Oh, that's
I was
so funny.
Kidding. It started because somebody recommended, if the blonde doesn't do the movie, the new movie.
Yeah, Samantha, Kim Cattrall, she's not doing it. You should do it.
Kim Cattrall, he said I should do
You should. Do you know Michael Patrick King? Of course you do, right?
No, I mean, I know of him. I don't
know. You would be great. I'll tell him. I'll send him a message. You would be great at it. Can you imagine? Would you do a sex scene? Have you done a sex scene?
I don't think I have done a sex scene.
Is there a role that you haven't played? Like, I would love to see you, Leslie. Like, wouldn't it be interesting to do like an independent film, dramatic, you're the lead? Would you ever do that? That would be risky thing.
We've gotten so close with that and it just never happened.
I want you to do that.
Movie. Yeah, I would love to do that. I'm a good actor. You know, I'm an actor.
You're an Emmy winning actor. You're not a good actor. You're a great actor. And in fact, I wanted to go through, if I just listed some of your credits, I want to get just a one or two words on some of the projects, because I went through some of my favorites. And when you go through, Leslie, like, you have been in the zeitgeist for American television and movie viewers for how many years now?
82, 40.
Talk to me about what you remember of being on Murphy Brown, one of my favorites.
Candace telling me, I kept calling her Miss Bergen, and she said, call me Candace or Candy. Call me Candy. And I said, oh, no. No, I can't call you Candy. You're Candace. You're Miss Bergen.
Now, people that may not remember, Candace Bergen won like 5 or 6 Emmys in a row for Murphy Brown. I mean, she was like the queen of television. You were on, and was it just one episode?
7th episode pilot season. And I started what they kept for years. I was her secretary.
Yeah. And she'd always fire him.
Yeah. And I had been in prison for 15 years for a crime I didn't commit. And so she gets me out, does an expose, gets me out of prison. And then I don't have anywhere to go. And I'm still wearing macrame belts and platform shoes. I'm still wearing the clothes I wore to prison.
All right. What about Pee-wee's Playhouse? That's interesting. You were on that.
I played Busby, who was Pee-wee's neighbor. And Pee-wee, I only did one, maybe two. But Pee-wee would say, I was a thief. And I lived next door to him. And I'd steal his things. And so he would say, where's my cereal bowl? Busby! And then I ended up stealing his clothes and dressing up like him. And Miss Yvonne, the most beautiful woman in the world, Lynn Marie Stewart, says to me, Busby, why do you steal Pee-wee's things? And I said, because I don't have any friends. And I thought that if I acted like Pee-wee, oh, but you've got to just be yourself, Busby, and then you can have friends.
So, how do you remember all of this?
I don't know. I just remember because it was so much fun. It was a long time ago.
Was Paul Reubens, who was Pee-wee Herman, was he very different from his character off stage or off camera?
Yeah, he's kind of quiet, really. Mm-hmm. I like Paul. I like him a lot. He's very different. He's very smart. And it was fun. I do remember, because he wears so much panstick and makeup and stuff, they had to keep it really cold. That's all I remember. It was so cold during the shoot.
Speaking of makeup, you've done Star Trek Voyager as well. What do you remember from shooting that?
Oh, 8 hours. I'd get up. I had to be there. Yeah, in makeup. Flat on my back, straws up my nose. I had to be there by 3 a.m. 5 hours I laid there.
Oh my God.
40 separate prosthetic pieces, gold spec contact lenses, fake teeth that rubbed. It was just atrocious. And then I hold the record. It's the Westmores. It's a family of makeup. They go all the way back to the original Star Trek. And I think her name was Candace, one of the heirs to it all. But anyway, the Westmores, I hold for the longest, because they put me in makeup and then we started shooting and it was a very difficult day. And I was 22 hours in that makeup.
Wow. So then when you do a show like Reba, that's a lot easier, right?
Yeah.
Reba McEntire. And then what about The Help? That must have been so exciting. I love that movie, The Help. When that comes out and it's like the number one movie for weeks and weeks and weeks, and then all these Oscar nominations, Oscar wins. What is that experience like?
Well, just the shooting of it, because I knew Tate Taylor forever.
The director.
We had done a play together called Southern Baptist Sissies when he was an actor that Dale Shores wrote. Mm-hmm. And then all of a sudden, he had been doing all these tiny little indie films, and he would call me and say, be in this movie. I'd say, I'm not available, Tay. I can't, you know, drop big pay and stuff. So then my agent called and said, you want to do this one? He's directing The Help. I said, and it turns out that he knew Catherine Stockett, who wrote the book. They went to kindergarten together.
Oh, really?
And she had said to him, she couldn't sell the book. She couldn't even get a literary agent to look at it. 61 different literary agents turned it down, and then one picked it up. I hope I'm getting the whole story right. But anyway, she had told Tate said, well, let's just make a little indie film of it. Mm-hmm. And she said, okay. Well, then it did get picked up, and everybody came knocking, from the Spielberg to Oprah to everybody. And she would say, no, my friend Tate's going to direct it.
Wow.
I mean, and so we all took off for Jackson, Mississippi. And he got big houses for each of the big stars. Like Alice and Janie, you could rent in Jackson, Mississippi, an old plantation house for nothing. And then he had the people come in, that decorate for the movies and decorate each house. So Emma had her house. Jessica Chastain had her house. You know, they all had houses. Octavia had her house, Viola had her house, and we just would go have parties at night, you know, and go
really?
From house to house. And we had so much fun.
You know a thing or two about being on with Humongous Projects, Will and Grace. Let's talk about that quickly. You got to be on that show, which is one of the best shows in the history of television. And then again, on the reboot, you won your Emmy for being on that show. When you're on something that's like that hot in terms of like the number one show on television, all the awards, did you think you would be in Emmy contention for that?
No, gosh, no. In fact, when my manager called, he said, you're up for an Emmy. I said, for what? I thought maybe it was for one of my cartoon voices.
Yeah.
You know, I didn't know. I said, for what? He said, Will and Grace. I said, I said, but what's the category? He said, it's best guest actor in a comedy. I said, I'm not a guest actor. I've been on that show. I did.
but that category is for people who are on less than 6 episodes a season, right? And so it's a chance for, if you have a story arc, to get to, you know, to just be recognized for your major contribution. So you're nominated, OMG. And then you win the Emmy. And
I took my mother to the ceremony with me, and she leaned in. They were about to announce it, and she leaned in and she said, you're going to win. I said, well, you're my mother. Of course you think that. She goes, no, look to the left. And the cameras were slowly coming towards, you know, like rolling. Now, maybe they cover everybody, because that's what I thought. Mm-hmm. Maybe, but I don't think they'd have a camera for everybody. And the cameraman was just kind of slowly moving down, ready to go like that.
And so, and then do, when they announce your name and the crowd starts clapping, do you turn and look at your mom in the eye? What do you do?
Yes. And I didn't want to cry, but then I got on stage and on the front row were Warren Beatty and Annette Bening. I just remember that going, and they were going,
thumbs up, like clapping.
And I'm like, oh my God. Hi.
You know, you can't help, I would imagine, but go back to that little kid growing up in the deep South in moments like that, in moments like what happened to you during this quarantine, and reflect, you know, and thinking about how far we've come and how, because of people like you, kids think that this is normal now, that you can kind of be this openly gay and have this kind of success. And I wonder what you could, if you would, not to be cliche, but if you could talk to, you know, 8-year-old, 7-year-old Leslie, what would you want him to know?
I tell him everything is going to work out, honey. Yeah. It's going to work out. And it's like they tell us in recovery, it's going to be beyond your wildest imaginings, because you think, you know, like it's going to be like this. Here's what I thought when I first got to Hollywood. I wanted a house in the Hollywood Hills. I wanted to be kind of like a gay Hugh Hefner. Mm-hmm. I wanted to have 7 blonde boys that lived with me and giggled. And I was going to have brunches, which was kind of a new word. I'd never heard the word brunch.
Yeah.
Oh, that's very, I'm going to have a brunch. That started like in the 80s. People would say, let's have a little brunch. And I thought, oh, we're going to have brunches and everybody's going to come and we're going to sit around the pool and drink cocktails. It's, my life is so not bad. I thought I would kill myself. Boom. If I ended up in Hollywood Hills with 7 blonde boys, I would kill myself.
But isn't it funny that the happiness you need finds you, you know, and your
and
purpose?
It just finds you. And people say, oh, I don't know if I want to get old. Yes, you do. It's just wonderful. It's just wonderful getting older.
Well, listen, I think that, you know, when I think about you, it's somebody I love and respect and root for. And I have since before I ever met you, and to see you fall into this success. And I hate saying fall into it, to earn this kind of success just by being you, right? By being authentically you, by being present, by giving of yourself, not manufactured, but just authentically, is the purest kind of success you can have. Somebody once told me when I first started, they said, Ross, if you can get a job, if you can get a job being yourself, you'll be employed for the rest of your life. And I think that you not only have been employed for your entire life being yourself, I just think you got the biggest promotion in the history of show business during this time. And I'm so proud
of
you.
You know, this TV series, Phil is probably closest to me. I thought, why is this so easy? You know, I'll memorize my lines. I just walk in because I am. I'm just being me. So thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you so much for listening to that. And I hope you enjoyed it. And I hope it helped you get to know a man who I'm sure you adored, like we all did, a little bit more. The humanity of him, who he is, who he was. Ugh, that's so weird to say was when he was just here. It's so weird. Oh, yeah. Call your friends. I have to tell you, I've called so many of them in this week since I got the news that Leslie passed away. So many friends who are, you know, around his age, younger. And thing is, you just never know. It's can go like that. So reach out to somebody that you haven't talked to in a while. Tell them you love them. Make sure everybody around you knows how much you love them. Leslie, I love you. I always love you, Leslie, you know. And thank you for making the world a brighter place. And thank you, listeners, for letting me sort of go through this with you. Thank you. Bowen Yang was supposed to be on this week. We're going to have him on next week from SNL. He's, you know what? It's occurring to me now. People like Bowen are in SNL and people like me are on TV right now because of people like Leslie. You know what I mean? Isn't that something too? This one's for Leslie. Until next week. Bye-bye. Hey, it's me, Ross Matthews. Thanks so much for listening. It means a ton. Make sure you like us, give us a good review, and subscribe wherever you listen to your podcasts. And you can find us on video at Cumulus Podcast Network on YouTube.
The Rolling Stone Music Now podcast gets inside the biggest stories with Rolling Stone senior writer Brian Hyatt.
Now here is my conversation with Jacob Knoll. Your story is an amazing one, and obviously you lost your dad when you're only 1 year old.
It was definitely a screwy way to grow up. I think that a lot of people never heard of who I am, and then they see me join this band and they must think this kid must have just been handed everything, or nepotism kid. It's a gift that I have an opportunity to sing in such a big band like my father and my uncle's band, Sublime.
Rolling Stone Music Now, wherever you listen.